Finally, this hour, music in the digital decade. Way back when, the move from 78s to vinyl records let people listen longer, and the cassette tape made music portable. Over the past decade, the MP3 has yanked music free from any physical format entirely. As 2009 comes to a close, we'll be reporting on changes in music and the music business in the last 10 years. Today, Jacob Gantz has been talking with people about the evolution in music listening.
Let's start out with one unassailable fact about the way people listen to music in 2009.
Technology has spoken, the people have spoken, there's kind of no putting the genie back in the bottle.
That's Justin Mollette, the creator of the music website Muxtape. Suddenly, everything about the way we listen to music is different. Well, maybe not so suddenly. In this era of immediate gratification, it's easy to forget the history behind the effortless download, so here goes. In the middle of the 1990s, programmers came up with a method of shrinking the size of digital audio files. They called it MPEG-1 Audio Layer 3. At the very end of that decade, college student Sean Fanning started a web-based program called Napster that enabled users to share MP3 files. Feverish bootlegging followed. The recording industry battled back with lawsuits. Apple dominated the market for MP3 players with its iPod, released in late 2001. Online retailers began offering legal downloading alternatives. Apple dominated this market with iTunes. MP3 blogs, aggregators, and BitTorrent programs offered new ways to own music without actually paying for it. Record sales collapsed. But here's the thing. It's possible that music lovers today have more access and listen to more music than ever before.
There's just a staggering amount of music to listen to. There are days when I really don't know what to do.
That's Sasha Frere-Jones, the pop music critic for The New Yorker. He's not alone. Here's music journalist Maura Johnston.
When I was commuting, I used to bring this like huge wallet of CDs with me. So I had 24 CDs, which was like a big deal. But I mean, now you can just bring thousands of songs with you on the train. Like, you don't have to make those choices where you're thinking about, okay, well, I don't have the space to bring this, so what should I bring instead? I think that now it's shifted from a question of space to a question of time.
So what do we do when we're crunched for time? We multitask.
I listen to music when I do everything, basically. I never go out without my headphones on. Walking, subway, doing homework, airplane rides. I always have it on, basically.
That's Alejandro Cercas, an 18-year-old student in New York. He's standing in Union Square across the street from the empty shell of what was New York's last Virgin megastore. In fact, the city's last major chain music store, period. The crumbling of brick and mortar is a tough reality for Josh Madel, who, gulp, owns a record store in Manhattan called Other Music.
I think people know a lot more about music, they listen to a lot more music, but they're not necessarily owning it. Maybe they have a file of it that they listen to for a while and then it gets lost or they delete it. Or maybe they just stream it. Maybe they just listen to it on the band's MySpace pages. You know, whatever it is, you know, hear it in passing.
For Madel, that's the core flaw of the new listening experience.
I think that people's connection to these artists are maybe not as deep.
Time does kind of slip away when I'm listening to music. It's just like, whoa, what was I just listening to 2 seconds ago? But, I mean, you get kind of used to it.
Alejandro Cercas isn't the only music consumer in Union Square.
It's Chaithan.
Just Chaithan.
I don't go by last name. I'm an artist.
Chaithan is 23 years old. He's listening to Lady Gaga on his headphones.
I usually don't purchase a full album unless I like the artist. I'll buy songs here and there. I buy about like 10 songs a month.
Do you ever buy records in stores?
I do.
What type of stores do you go to?
I used to go to Virgin, that's right behind us, but it's closed, so I haven't bought an album since they closed.
There are still people who buy records at stores like Other Music, but Josh Madel says they're almost never as young as Chaithan. On the other hand, Madel knows that the internet feeds the open-mindedness of the customers who do still come into his store.
There is so much interesting, diverse music from around the world that is able to find an audience now.
Which is indisputably a good thing for everybody. And Sasha Frere-Jones says MP3s make it quick and easy.
MP3s are kind of the best and the worst thing in the world. We've never been able to trade music so quickly. I will talk to somebody on IM and they will give me a song while we're talking. But I don't really like how MP3s sound.
We used to hear big sound coming out of big speakers. Our friends would come over and listen to a brand new album we just took out of the shrink wrap. Now we download songs from MP3 blogs, post a link on Sendspace and send a note to friends, or stream the song from our Tumblr.
Because of MP3s, everyone can get their hands on it right away. I always think of that as a conversation. That's the word I have in my head.
Instead of the conversation happening between a few friends, you can now listen to music with anyone, anywhere, any way you want. Take the website muxtape.com. It launched in March 2007. The project of web designer Justin Ouellette, it served one simple purpose. It was an internet-based mixtape site. No dating, no video games, no blogging, no user profiles, just 12 songs from your own music collection that you could upload to the site for others to stream. The response was immediate. A huge community of music fans sharing their tastes without actually trading files. Even so, Ouellette says record companies were quick to object. Ouellette got his first letter within a few days of the site going live.
They actually saw the potential in it.
Then they shut it down. But even within the industry, there's been a recognition that an era has ended.
I was talking to the head of a label. He's from the vinyl generation, and he said, "Now I even feel like it's a big deal to turn to the CD player and put a CD in. You're so used to clicking on links and having it be right there."
The New Yorker's Sasha Ferrer-Jones says telling people how they're supposed to listen to music is a losing game.
To tell a kid, "Oh, that iPod, you know, forget that. I want you to go out and buy a turntable and an amplifier and two speakers, and then you got to take the record out of the sleeve. You know, they'll be asleep before you finish your sentence."
If technology today speaks in the voice of the consumer, what does a musician have to do to get into the conversation? That story tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. As we look back on the decade in music, we can't ignore revolutionary changes in technology. Yesterday, we reported on how the MP3 and the internet have made collecting music, sharing it, and listening to it easier for fans. Today, we're going to the other side of the creative fence, to musicians and people in the business. Jacob Gans talked with some of them to find out how the digital decade has changed the making and distributing of music.
Maybe the best way to sum up the reality of the music industry in 2009 is to listen to Steve Albini in an interview with the musician Ian Svenonius for the website VBS.tv. Keep in mind, Albini recorded classic albums by the Pixies and Nirvana and has always loudly favored analog recording. He says the current digital trends don't bother him.
I see these changes as changes that are happening outside of me that I have no control over. So I basically treat them like the weather. Like, oh, it's going to be kind of bloggy and MP3 for a while.
The music industry spent most of the last decade caught outside without a raincoat. Record labels, especially the big ones, didn't embrace digital music at first. In fact, they spent a lot of time and energy suing the source of their income, consumers. Today, many musicians have abandoned the stick for the carrot. It's common to give away an MP3 from a new album for free or stream that new album in its entirety before it comes out in stores or on iTunes. The band of Montreal still wants you to buy its records, but last year, when it was time to release a new album, that band's leader, Kevin Barnes, started thinking about the ways in which the industry's preferred formats hadn't caught up to listeners' preferences.
The download thing is probably the wave of the future, and CDs, they'll just become, you know, like the 8-track or whatever.
Not convinced that MP3s form lasting connections, Barnes enlisted his brother David, an artist, to help him reimagine the physical presentation of that new album called Skeletal Lamping. So if you bought it as an MP3 download, you could look forward to getting, via snail mail, stuff in place of a plastic disc. A Skeletal Lamping paper lantern, or a Skeletal Lamping t-shirt, or a Skeletal Lamping tote bag, or Skeletal Lamping horse-themed wall decals.
That's how it works. It's like, why would I buy that record? It just has the CD. I want that one. Like, Kevin's funniest version of it would be, like, you get the album, and it comes with, like, this amazing sandwich that comes with a download.
Yeah, it could be anything.
Gimmicks be damned, Kevin Barnes still believes in the concept of the album.
The records that we really love are the records that, you know, every single song, every single lyric, every single section of every song is sacred and important. And so, you know, when we're making records, we're trying to create something like that. We don't think of it as just, okay, you know, we're just going to make a couple songs that people put in their iPod shuffle and, you know, they're done with it. Just know how to make it like this.
Other musicians have less of a problem with listeners removing individual songs from their context. David Rawlings is best known for his collaborations with Gillian Welch. He says that he's happy to be part of people's lives no matter how.
if anything, all of this availability and convenience has made it so that people have incorporated music even more into their lives. Whether or not you're walking on your commute or whatever, music has the ability to transport you at that moment. So I think it's just people manipulating their environment in a way that they find pleasurable.
The mechanics of how listeners find that music has become crucial to musicians and the traditional recording industry. Julie Greenwald is the chairman and COO of the Atlantic Records Group.
It used to be you had like three things you had to concentrate on: physical retail, radio, and the video channel. And if you could get those three dots lined up, wow, you were selling records. Now you have like 20 other dots to connect. We have people just dedicated to MySpace, to Facebook, to iMeme, to make sure that our content is going up there. Now we have 29 dots, and they're all just as important and all have to be worked.
None of which, unfortunately for artists and labels, has actually helped to sell more music this decade. And fans are increasingly demanding a personal connection with their favorites. You can read about John Mayer's issues with tuna fish on his Twitter feed, but most of those 20 new dots involve an experience mediated through a filter that probably doesn't have anything to do with melody or lyrics. Most musicians still want that personal connection with listeners forged through their music, and that means they have a power that nobody, not record labels, not file-sharing music fans, can take away. In 2001, in the aftermath of the Napster file-sharing lawsuits, Gillian Welch released an album that included a song called Everything Is Free.
Everything is free now. That's what they say. Everything I ever done, gonna give it away.
It starts out like a lament, but Welch says that was only part of her intention.
Ultimately, it's really more of a threat, the ultimate threat that the artist has at any point to stop sharing their art with the world. I can keep doing what I do, and I can entertain myself. If it ceases to be feasible to make a living at it, I could just stop going public with it.
Maybe this was the decade that made everyone question their place in the chain. Listeners became writers or librarians or mini labels. Labels went from litigants to friends on Facebook. Musicians became bloggers or wall decal manufacturers. Thankfully, they're also still making music. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gant.
Every day I wake up.
And you can explore our full coverage of the past decade in music at nprmusic.org.
But I don't need to run around. I just stay.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Much like jazz musicians today, singers during the Renaissance embellished melodies with improvisation that was called diminuito, and that is the title of a new album. It comes from the lute player Rolf Lieslevand and his ensemble. They perform music from the 16th century, and they use improvisation to push it in a new direction. Here's critic Tom Manoff.
Improvisation combines musical thinking with musical imagination. And when both meet on equal ground, the result is powerful and poetic. Rarely do I encounter a CD on which each successive track becomes a favorite. Not only does every piece on this album strike the ear instantly as compelling, each becomes part of a longer journey. And there's definitely a sense of narrative here, a sense of storytelling, if only in the imagination. If you think of lutes as producing only delicate pluck tones, you'll be surprised by their forceful sound in this ensemble, which also includes other stringed instruments, a small pipe organ, and an array of exotic percussion.
Mm-hmm.
The acoustics of this recording swirl in contrasting sound colors and lush harmonics. Occasionally, singers join in, floating above the instruments, an ethereal effect, which lends a sense of timelessness to the music. Although based in the Renaissance, Diminuito is sometimes hard to place. It's classical music, certainly, but influenced also by folk and world music. Additionally, the musicians have used modern recording technology to create its richly layered sound. While these influences may deprive the album of some historical authenticity, they speak to a deeper authenticity, a creative process responsible only to pure imagination.
That was Tom Manoff reviewing the new album by Rafaliz Levand. It's called Diminuito. You can hear more songs from the album and find more classical music at nprmusic.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.